So, like all the, like a flamboyant, all the Siddhis, you know, he used to flamboyantly just throw around, you know.
Yeah.
Another case, perhaps more surprising, is recorded when a blind woman cried out, "Baba, I want to see you with these eyes." Immediately she was able to see. But no sooner did she go out of his presence than her blindness returned. What she asked for had been granted. 1913, Biu Bahalkar's little son had high fever for 5 or 6 days, and the doctor told him that there was little hope. Bahalkar then down and prayed to Sai Baba. They put in parentheses here. I guess he bowed, prostrate. I don't know. He just said Bahalkar then down and prayed. They don't say what he did. There's a mistake there. The Hindu normally prays sitting cross-legged, not kneeling. Is that true? What the Hindus?
Yes.
They pray cross-legged. They don't kneel. At the Arthurata. And at 2 o'clock in the night, Sai Baba appeared in his room, applied udi, I think it's some ashes or something,
udi, yeah,
to the child and said, "There's no more need to worry. In 2 hours, the boy will perspire, and in the morning, he'll feel better. When he's quite well, bring him to me." Of course, it happened as he said. It was on the 3rd March in Bahalkar's house in Dhulia. 2 days later, he received a letter from Deshpande, who was staying at Shirdi, in which he wrote that Sai Baba had said to him, "I've been to your Dhulia friend's house, Deshpande, and asked him, Deshpande had asked him, what friend? And he replied, Upasani Bahalkar. I go to his house daily. You had better write to him." Once in a typically flamboyant style, Sai Baba said to Mahal Sapati, a resident devotee, "Your wife has very painful tumor on her neck. I will cure it. No one else will cure it. Only I." Mahal Sapati's wife was not at Shirdi at the time, and he did not even know that she had a tumor. Later he received a letter about it and its sudden cure. The following might be called a test case. Mr. M.W. Pradhan, a justice of peace, had related how his young son, Babu, fell ill. They had in their house a Telugu priest who, as is not uncommon in well-to-do families, performed all the ritual worship for them. This priest, Madhava Bhatt, was strongly attached to the family but was not a devotee of Sai Baba. On the contrary, he thought the child's sickness might be a punishment for worshipping one whom he considered a Muslim. He therefore asked the parents to go and make a vow to Datta, an aspect of God, which they worship, and pray for the child's recovery. But they told him that Sai Baba was Datta. One night he saw in a dream a figure that he recognized from the picture in the house as Sai Baba, sitting at the top of the staircase with a short stick in his hand. In the dream, Sai Baba said to him, "What do you mean? I am the lord of this house." Bhatt kept the dream to himself, but the child's condition continued to get worse. Finally, he could stand the strain no longer, and running to the picture of Sai Baba, he cried out, "If the child improves enough to be brought downstairs by 4 o'clock in this afternoon, I'll agree that you are Datta." The temperature began to go down, and by 4 o'clock, the boy himself asked his mother to take him downstairs and let him play. And finally, a case where the sickness was not merely cured, but foreseen. SSD Nomankar, a police inspector, was on his way from Pune to Niman, where his brother's wife had recently given birth to a child. He stopped at Shirdi on the way to see Sai Baba. As he was taking leave, Sai Baba gave him the usual udhi, saying to him, "Save the child's life." On his arrival at Niman, he found the newborn child all but dead. Breathing had almost stopped, and the parents had lost hope. He looked for the udhi that he had been given, but could not find it. He must have lost it on the way. Nevertheless, he took the child on his lap and prayed to Sai Baba for help. And within 15 minutes, the crisis had passed, and the child began to recover. Sai Baba's help was also manifested frequently in giving issue to the childless. As with most things, the method was symbolical. Usually he would give a coconut in token of fertility, sometimes some other fruit. On one occasion it was the breaking of a coconut that he showed reluctance. Several times putting it aside until the last devotee persuaded him. Diaz Razane, having no children, married a second wife. But this marriage also remained barren. Should be explained in parentheses that even before the new law forbidding polygamy, the enormous majority of Hindus were monogamous. But if a man had no son to perform the funeral rites for him, he could take a second wife with the consent of the first. One day, on Razane's arrival at Shirdi, Sai Baba immediately handed him 4 mangoes and, addressing him by the diminutive of his first name, said, "Dhania, take these mangoes, eat them and die." Symbolical, as usual, Razane was taken aback until it was explained to him by others that to beget a son is equivalent to dying and being replaced by another. You know, someone's going to come and replace you. Soon you're going to die. No one gets out of here alive. To plunge into the life of the world is death. To remain calm and aloof is life. Baba continued, "Don't eat them yourself. Give them to your wife." "Which wife?" he asked. "The second. Let her eat them, and she will have 2 sons. The first is to be named Dhalat Shah, and the second Tana Shah." Later, Sai Baba told him that he would have 8 children in all, which proved true. On the birth of his first son, he came to Sai Baba and asked him what name to give it. Despite all the people he had met and all that had happened between, Sai Baba instantly replied, "Have you forgotten what I told you? You wrote it down on page 3 of your notebook. Didn't I tell you he was to be called Dhalat Shah?" It was a complicated case, with one Sapat Nikar extending over many years. A spiritual master had enormous patience. It is no use trying to pick unripe fruit, and he'll wait patiently through the years for it to open. Sai Baba was first brought to Sapatnekar's notice when he was a young man taking his law examination. He turned to a friend who was notoriously weak in studies and, rather unkindly, asked him how he expected to fare. The friend replied with complete confidence that he would pass because he had Sai Baba's assurance. Sapatnekar made fun both of his friend and Sai Baba and predicted the worst. Actually, the friend did pass, But Sapatnekar was not convinced. He regarded it as a lucky chance. He himself passed, set up as a lawyer, married and had a son. 10 years later, his son died, and he had no other child. He remembered the way he had spoken about Sai Baba and began to worry about it, wondering whether his son's death was in retribution. He decided to go and see him and apologize. Sai Baba, however, shouted roughly at him and drove him away at sight. Again he came and bowed down, and again he was driven away. About a year later, however, Sai Baba appeared to his wife in a dream and invited them both to go to him. This time, Sapatnekar was received graciously and apologized for his past contempt. Sai Baba then turned to someone who was standing by and told the story of Sapatnekar's life in the first person, as though it was his own. Then pointing at him, he said, "This man blames me because he thinks I killed his son. But now I'm going to bring that same soul back into his wife's womb." He's just playing around with everyone. It's a play game for him. When he was taking leave, Sai Baba gave him a coconut and bade him to tie it in his wife's shawl and go away rejoicing. A year later, he brought to Sai Baba the child that had been born. Another devotee, L.G. Mungay, had several children, but they all died in infancy. You know, this is all before 1918. Mm-hmm. He died in 1918, I think, Sai Baba. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of children died back then.
Yeah, there's a lot of child mortality back then. He went to Sai Baba and complained of his misfortune, praying for one son that would live. Baba immediately replied, "Why do you ask me for one? I'll give you two." Like, I'm just playing the game for him, you know? And in fact, he got two sons and two daughters. But a condition for getting these favors was faith and submission. We have seen in the case of Sapatnekar how Sai Baba waited until the submission had matured. And now an instance where it was lacking. It was sometime in 1910. Suddenly, one morning, Sai Baba burst out, "What is the scoundrel coming to see me for? What have I got? I'm just a naked fakir with human organs, like anyone else." It was one of those outbursts when no one knew what he was referring to. A little later, however, a couple of official carriages drew up with their escort outside the mosque. The wife of the district revenue commissioner, an English lady, had long hoped for a child and now thought she would try the wonder-working fakir whom all the Indians were talking about. She was accompanied by her husband and by the collector, a title which the British India signified the local administrative officer, the most important man in the district. They looked around uneasily. This base, primitive environment was no setting for members of the ruling class. The assistant commissioner, who had accompanied them, saw a devotee waiting about in the yard outside the mosque and, calling to him, bade him to ask Sai Baba to finish his morning routine quickly, as the sahibs wished to speak to him. The devotee was aghast, finding as the word of a sahib was, he could not take such a message to Sai Baba. He did not even pretend to do so, but declared outright that it was impossible. If they had any business with Sai Baba, they must await his pleasure. It was a half an hour before he was free and came that way. The lady stepped up to him and, bowing, said politely, "We wish to have a little talk with you, Maharaj." However, such politeness was not enough for Sai Baba. It was not the heartfelt devotion he required. He said roughly, "You must wait half an hour. I have to go and beg." All his life, however, much wealth flowed in. Sai Baba retained his custom of begging his food. Actually, he went only to a few houses which considered it an honor to feed him. And sometimes he delegated a devotee to beg for him. To make the white sahibs wait while a fakir begged his food was a lesson of humility typical of his bizarre humor. Also, it was open to them to remove the necessity for begging by contributing or obtaining supplies for him if they had thought of doing so. It was not in half an hour, but only 10 minutes later when he returned. Again, the lady bowed and repeated her request. "Wait an hour longer," he replied. The officers of the government had not the time, nor were they disposed to be made fools of in this way by a mere fakir. They got into their carriages and rode away, and the lady remained childless. Cures for the sick and children for the barren were the most frequent benefits. But whether it was an examination to pass, a job to obtain, a lawsuit to win, or a marriage to arrange, devotees would appeal to Sai Baba. And if the request for aid was made with faith and sincerity, it was likely to be granted. So much can easily be said of Sai Baba by all, by mere observers from the outside, explained G.G. Narke, a professor. Do you say Narke, N-A-R-K-E? Do you say Narke or Narke? Narke?
Narke.
Narke, yeah. A professor of geology at the Dakin Yam Kana College of Engineering and a devotee to whom we shall often have to refer to for deeper interpretation of Sai Baba. But anyone who judged him from the outside like this was very far out in his appraisal. Baba was, of course, adapting himself to the capacity for understanding of the people who came to him for help and protection. Most of them were superficial and sought only material benefits. And to them, he did not reveal his inner nature. But when one capable of diving deeper came to him, he revealed more of himself and his true powers. Sometimes in performing a miracle, he would say, "I will do this." More often, however, his reply would be, "Allah acha kareda."
Allah acha, Allah will do good.
Say it again.
Allah will do good.
Oh, okay.
Allah acha, good, and karega. Will do. Here they put the
translation.
God will put it right.
Okay.
Or Allah Malik Hai. Allah Malik Hai. Allah is the ruler.
Yeah.
The Malik. It was a peculiar custom of his to refer to God as the fakir. And when refusing a request, he would often say, "The fakir will not let me do that." Or, "I can only do what the fakir orders me to do." He often did refuse. Sometimes he would explain that to prolong the life of a sick person would only cause prolonged suffering. Sometimes he would promise to bring him back in a new birth. Sometimes when asked to bless with issue, he would say that there was no child in that person's destiny. Not that this always deterred him, for at least on one occasion he granted a child out of his own destiny, declaring that There was none in that of the petitioner. Sometimes he would give no explanation at all, but simply refuse, saying, Allah Malik Hai, or the fakir will not let me. B.A. Patel was a landowner and revenue officer. His aged father had a stroke. He went to Sai Baba to ask for udhi for him. But Sai Baba said, I will not give you udhi. Allah Malik Hai. 3 days later, the father died. This Patel was very proud of his physical strength. It was in 1913 when Sai Baba was already old and frail, and Patel would often massage his leg and then pick him up bodily and carry him to the fire. One day, soon after his father's death, he tried to do this but was utterly unable to move him. Baba laughed at him, and Patel records, he taught me two things, not to be proud of my strength and not to grieve for my father. Sai Baba said to him, why should you grieve? In 5 months he will return. In 5 months a son was born to Patel. There is the plain meaning that this was the rebirth of his father, or the profounder meaning that the life force which had taken on a form to which he was attached would do so again. Since he had failed to destroy attachment at its roots. A woman's young son was bitten by a cobra, and she cried out and begged Sai Baba for udhi, but he did not give it, and the child died. H.S. Dixit, one of the oldest of the devotees, implored him, Baba, her crying to hear is heart-rending. For my sake, revive her son. Here again, as in the incident of curing child's eyes with onion, it is striking to see that there was never the slightest doubt that he could do this. Sai Baba replied, do not get entangled in this. What has happened is for the best. He has entered another body in which he can do specially good work, which he could not do in this one. If I draw him back into this body, then the new one he has entered will have to die for this to live. I might do it for your sake, but have you considered the consequences? Have you any idea of the responsibility? And are you prepared to assume it? Death to one form is always birth to another, except in the case of the jnani, the fully enlightened or self-realized sage, who passes beyond forms to the formless infinite, which is spoken of as moksha or nirvana. S.B. Mohale had a daughter with a hair lip, and took her to Sai Baba, hoping he could cure her. As soon as he arrived, Sai Baba said, I know what you have come for, but it would be useless. The girl is of divine nature, Daivi, and her life on earth will be short. Next, Nagha Shuddha Chaturi Day, she will die. If you go to your office on that day and do not stay at home, you will not see her again. And it happened so. She died on that day while her father, who had ignored the warning, was at his office. At least one case is recorded when Sai Baba wrestled in vain for a life. There was an outbreak of bubonic plague in Nigoj village, and the wife of the patil, or squire, had fallen ill. Sai Baba was passing that night at the Chavadi or rest house with Mahasapati in attendance. "Don't sleep tonight," Sai Baba bade him. "Stand and keep watch for me the whole night, because I have to pray to God. That ruffian, the plague, wants to kill the woman, so I am praying to Allah." Mahasapati kept watch through the night to prevent any disturbance, but just before morning an official arrived with a body of servants. They made a great commotion, shouting that he wanted darshan, an interview with Sai Baba. Mahasapati tried to quiet them by giving them udhi, but in vain. Sai Baba burst forth from the rest house in a raging temper, shouting and abusing Mahasapati. He cried, "Are you the father of a family? Don't you know what is happening in the Goj? Why do you omit people at such time?" Then suddenly he was calm. "So be it. What has happened is right." And that morning, the Patel's wife died. Despite the many favors he granted, Sai Baba could be a hard master. There were few who escaped his blows or abuse. And it was not necessary for a selfish thought to crystallize in speech or action for it to be punished. The thought itself was enough. A devotee has told how he was sitting there when someone brought a present of pink bananas, a variety with a rare flavor that grows only in a certain altitude in the hills. Seeing Sai Baba peeling them and giving them away, he felt an involuntary fear that they would all be finished before his turn came. Sai Baba immediately peeled another, gave it to someone else, and threw him the skin, bidding him to eat it. "Eat that." He did so, accepting it meekly as a punishment for his greed. Sai Baba was pleased at this and, peeling another banana, shared it with him. A Muslim woman who kept purda bowed down at Sai Baba's feet, unveiling her face. A devotee sitting beside him observed how beautiful she was and felt a hope that she would show her face again. Without a word, Sai Baba swung around and dealt him a blow with a stick. A leper clambered slowly up the steps to the mosque. He was filthy and almost naked, covered with sores and stinking of rotting flesh. You know, I used to see lepers when I first went to India. You mm-hmm. don't see them now.
No, you don't see them. How can you tell
them first? Oh, you know, their nose falls off, fingers fall off.
Hands, feet.
Covered with sores and stinking of rotting flesh. His feet were affected by the disease. So it seemed to take ages for him to approach Sai Baba and prostrate himself before him. Then he turned to go, and when at last he was down the steps, the elegant Mrs. Manager, someone who, I guess she was a manager of that Sirdi front, you know, the mosque mm-hmm. and everything. Some devotee, they call her Mrs. Manager. Must be just, wasn't really her name, but she was an Indian, you know. Mrs. Manager felt a wave of relief. Sai Baba sent a devotee to call him back. Again, the slow clambering up the steps, the tottering nearer, the foul stench. This time, as he prostrated himself, Sai Baba picked up a dirty cloth bundle that he had been carrying and opened it. Milk sweet. Good. He took one and of all those present, gave one to Mrs. Manager. Such was her devotion that she ate it without demur. One test of faith was when devotees were not allowed to leave Shirdi on the date they had planned. It was the practice, as with any other guru, to ask permission to leave. But he did not always grant it. If the devotee's leave or absence was due to expire, or if he had some business or other appointment, this could be very awkward. None ever suffered by it. Somehow matters turned out so that no harm was done. But great faith was needed to believe that beforehand. H.V. Sakti has related a typical instance. He was serving on a committee with the revenue commissioner, of whom we have already heard, the collector. They were due to meet at Manmad and set out from there on a tour of inspection. And the day before they were to meet, Sati sent his father-in-law to Sai Baba to ask leave for him to depart. But Sai Baba refused. Sati told his father-in-law that he could not trifle with important official engagements, or he might be thrown out of government service altogether. Again, the older man went to ask permission, and again Sai Baba refused, even ordering him to lock Sati in his room if he tried to go. It was 3 days before he was allowed to leave for Manmad. On arrival there, he found that the other members of the committee had altered the original program and postponed the meeting. On the strength of the original program, he had ordered his tent and equipment to be sent to Manmad, but by a strange inadvertence, this had not been done. So by my detention at Shirdi, I lost absolutely nothing except my peace of mind, and was saved a lot of unnecessary trouble, and enabled to spend more time with my family and with Sai Baba. Of course, Sai Baba knew and arranged all this, but in my ignorance, I was very uneasy about staying at Shirdi. Such instances strengthen one's faith in Sai Baba's and reliance on him. It can further be added that if his faith had been stronger, he would not have lost his peace of mind. It was quite safe to stay at Shirdi when Sai Baba ordered it. It was by leaving without permission that a man invited trouble. The following case of Abdur Rahim Shamsuddin Nangari, a Muslim devotee, illustrates that. In 1913, there was plague at Tana, where I lived, and also, I think, at Shirdi. My wife had been suffering for a month from some disease. Her throat and cheek were swollen, and she could not eat anything. She was taking medicine, but it did not help her. A Hindu neighbor, R.G. Gupta, a lawyer, advised me to take her to Sai Baba at Shirdi, as that would cure her. When we started out, she was unable to swallow anything, but by the time we reached Igatpuri, she could take tea, and by Nasik, she could eat something. This was a good omen. She was improving rapidly. On reaching Shirdi, I went to the mosque and bowed down before Sai Baba. He asked me in Hindustani where I had come from and why, and told me to bring my wife to the mosque. So they didn't speak Hindi there. They spoke what? In Shirdi.
In Maharashtra.
Maharashtra.
Yeah. Is it like
any? No, it's different.
No, it's different dialect.
The scriptures, Devanagari.
I took her up the steps, and she bowed before him. He put his hand on her head and said, Kuda acha karega.
Kuda, God.
God will put it right. I gave him 1 rupee, 4 annas, without being asked, and he accepted it and gave me uti. I stayed there for 2 hours. My wife's swelling was subsiding fast. So he started back at once, without taking leave of Sai Baba. He had told me to stay, but since a cure had been effected, I thought we might as well start. I did not like to stay at a strange place longer than necessary, especially with my wife and 2-year-old son. The tonga, the carriage, in which we had come, was still in the village. So we took it and started back to Kopergoan, about 6 miles away. We had gone about half the distance when the axle of the tonga broke, and we were left stranded on the road. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and there was no traffic. We could neither walk forward nor back, such a distance at night. It was a lonely road, and our predicament was uninviolable. Exposed to the night weather, and in danger of highwaymen who infested the roads. We repented now our disregard of Sai Baba's words. 2 hours passed in this way, and then we heard the rattle of a carriage approaching, and a voice calling out, "Where is that fellow Tana?" The Tanga came up to us, seeing that it was the driver who was calling out. I told him that I was from Tana, and that's how he knew our plight, and happened to arrive there at such an unusual hour. He said that Sai Baba had sent her. "What for?" I asked him. "To fetch you," he replied. So we got into the Tanga and went back to Shirdi. It was between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning when we arrived there. Baba was waiting for us at the mosque. He said, "You left without permission. That's why you had this trouble." I admitted it and asked for forgiveness. He made us stay near the mosque for the rest of the night while he went in and carried on his usual meditation. You know, he used to sleep in this, it was like a platform on ropes, 6 feet high, like against a building, something very, that he used to sleep in. And no one used to see him sleeping there, how he got up there and everything. And then some people came in and looking at it and investigating, and he took it down and he smashed it to pieces. Oh. Like I said earlier. But they said they never used to see him meditate.
Oh.
You know, he was always like in... The state didn't make any difference. This is a game. This is a game for him. You know, I mean, the whole life. In the morning, he went out to beg and came back with some bread and vegetables, of which he took a part and gave the rest to us. My wife was able to eat solid food. You know, there's some movie of him. You can see him on YouTube. I mean, walking around and,
okay.
They had movie camera back then.
Oh, that's nice.
I think I've seen it, I think. Just, you know, very brief, sitting around and I'm going to look at that again for a long time. This was my only visit to Shirdi, but it gave me firm faith in Sai Baba. All these signs and wonders attracted people. But it was for spiritual benefit that the permanent devotees looked. Nor did they always have to go to Shirdi. He would say to them, "I am not confined to Shirdi or to this body. I am everywhere. I am with you whenever you think of me." Physically, he never left Shirdi. One devotee tells how, when he was getting married, His father employed Sai Baba to attend the ceremony. He replied, "Never fear, I am with you. Wherever you are, I am with you, if you think of me." When further pressed, he said, "Without God's permission, I can do nothing." Spiritual development was the real boon. Rao Sahib Galwankar, who had been quoted already in this connection, says, "When he placed his hand over my head, it had an extraordinary effect on me. I forgot myself and my surroundings and passed into an ecstatic condition. After this ecstasy, I began to pay more attention to the spiritual side of life." Then came the second stage in 1932, that is 14 years after Sai Baba's death, when Baba appeared to me in a dream and asked me what I wanted. I replied that I wanted prem, divine love, and that alone. Baba blessed me with prem and disappeared. Ever since then, I have had spells of prem gushing forth through me when I am in meditation, or even when I am reading or doing something else. But to counterbalance the impression left by outer wonders and an eccentric manner, let this chapter end as it began, with a devotee's impression of Sai Baba. This time, Rao Bahadur Dumal, a Brahmin and an advocate. He said, "I have one great difficulty when asked, what are my experiences of Sai Baba? That is that at all hours of the day and night, I am having experience of him. There is no incident in my life that I do not connect with him, however trivial it may appear to be. I firmly believe that everything in my life is swayed by Baba. What then is to be mentioned as my experience of him? Of course, the outside world will not be prepared to credit my belief, but that does not matter to me. In fact, the very belief of people seems a valid reason for refusing to disclose one's experiences. Every devotee feels that his experiences are his own and are given to him for his spiritual and temporal benefit, and not for ventilation or publication to the general public. The best way of understanding Baba is to experience him oneself. Where is Baba gone? He is still alive and active, more active, if it were possible, than he was before his Mahasamadhi. Anyone who is in real earnest can get in touch with him today and at once. But one who will not do that, but seeks experiences at second or third hand, will get very poor stuff." Then chapter 3, Hinduism and Islam. Meteorologist?
Because Gandhi was here. Gandhi Rao.
So where does he work?
He's a meteorologist. I don't remember where.
Meteorological consultant. He's a consultant. Turn around.